April 22nd, 1987, House Judiciary Subcommittee 3.
Can I have your attention? This is the House Judiciary Committee Subcommittee 3. We have been called other things too. We will be going through our work session as I earlier described, except for House Bill 2223, which will be put at the end of the work session, and 2879, which is set over. And after we finish the 2324, we will then proceed on to the public hearing, which is on House Bill 3374. With that, let's get underway to see how we can get through. And the first thing that we have relates to something that came up when the main committee and the subcommittee was discussing the issue of joint custody, and we have an informational testimony from Mr. Neely of Adult and Family Services. Mr. Neely, come forward. And that is on the issue of the effect of award of custody on a parent's ability to qualify or remain qualified for public assistance.
Oh,
remember that, Bill?
Yeah. I remember the report.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jim Neely. I'm the Assistant Manager of the Income Maintenance Section of Adult and Family Services Division. I appreciate this opportunity to discuss the effects of joint custody arrangements on the eligibility for public assistance with this committee. There has been a concern for some time about joint custody in the Aid to Dependent Children program. Concerns become more problematic in recent years as more and more courts consider joint custody in dissolution cases. The reason this comes up, it causes some problems on two separate fronts from the eligibility standpoint. First, the Social Security Act itself contains law relating to eligibility for ADC. While the stated purpose of this section of the Social Security Act is to help maintain and strengthen family life, the particular eligibility that we're talking about here is based on deprivation due to continued absence. So at some point, increased interaction with the absent parent comes to mean that the parent is no longer absent and that eligibility no longer exists. And that the particular wording of the act is that such absence must interrupt or terminate the parent's functioning as a provider of maintenance, physical care, or guidance. Secondly, because of the cost of operating the ADC program, adjustments to definitions that make more or fewer persons eligible for public assistance tend to have a considerable fiscal impact. Currently, the ADC caseload is in the neighborhood of 30,000 cases. A swing of 100 cases over the biennium has a fiscal impact of approximately $1.3 million. Total funds, roughly $500,000 general fund. Currently, Oregon has what I'd say is a middle of the road policy related to continued absence. And I've attached to the testimony three pages from our policy, and these are administrative rules that talk about this. Continued absence exists when the parent is out of the home and the nature of the absence is such as to either interrupt or terminate the parent's functioning as a provider of maintenance, physical care, or guidance. It's on page one. I should mention here there's some significant interaction here between times in which the state operates a two-parent program and when they do not. When there is a two-parent or unemployed parent program in operation, the question of whether or not the absent parent is truly absent tends to decrease significantly. On page two, talks about a little more detail in sub 3. It shall be assumed that a child is not deprived of parental support or care based on the continued absence of a parent when the absent parent's visitation in the child's home exceeds 4 visits per week or 12 hours per week. Following that, it's expanded slightly to say that visitation based on a court order may be whatever the court specifies as long as the actual visitation by the absent parent is less than 50% per month. And what we're looking at here with the 50% per month is one of the parents is the caretaker relative for this child and the other parent is absent in this case. And when the child spends more than half the time with the absent parent, and the person who is receiving grant monies is not really the caretaker relative. As a result of House Bill 2480 in the last session, we made a change to specifically state that a determination that a needy child is not deprived of parental support or care by reason of the continued absence of a parent shall not be based solely on an award by a court of joint legal custody. That wasn't really a change from what we were doing, but we put it in there to clarify. Practicing joint custody, in which custody is actually split 50-50, precludes eligibility for public assistance under our policy at this point. I don't know if I've enlightened you or made it worse. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you have.
Questions?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bellamy.
I think you're going to have to get it a little more understandable. I can. In essence, would most people, if they have a joint custody agreement, and let's say that they did not meet the qualification of 4 visits per week, would the individual be deprived of ADC payments then?
The award of joint custody in itself really has no bearing on whether or not they'd be eligible for ADC. If they actually practice joint custody, whether or not the court has awarded joint custody, if the parents actually split responsibility for maintaining the child 50-50, then they are not eligible for public assistance. The fact that the court has awarded joint custody is not important as far as our policy is concerned. It's the practice that's important.
Let me ask the question then, why is it the practice of support of where they share the child 50-50 that you will not allow any ADC payments?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bellamy, the problem with that we face in that regard is that at some point, as you get closer to the edge of what the federal government defines as allowable deprivation, allowable eligibility based on deprivation, you get closer to interpretive problems with, are the feds going to say, no, that child is not deprived. He sees both parents, perhaps more often than a two-parent family would be interacting with the child, and they're not eligible for public assistance under federal law. The whole problem here is we have what we intend to do is strengthen family life, and yet we're saying this person is eligible for public assistance because they are deprived of parental support. When that parental support becomes shared equally, then we can't consider them deprived.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bellamy.
I guess I don't see the relationship. The ADC is supposed to have to do with the fact of whether or not they financially can support the family, the children, and the spouse. Why does the factor of being shared by both parents, even though they're not living together, have more weight than the actual financial?
Representative, it's a combination of three factors that the feds point out. It's maintenance, physical care and guidance. And it's not solely maintenance. If it were solely maintenance and the parent were in the home, you could have continued absence and eligibility for public assistance for the ADC program when both parents are in the home. And that, under federal law, only occurs if the state operates a two-parent program. So that they're really looking at the fact that one parent is continually absent, not just that the family cannot afford to support the children. It's more than just a maintenance question.
Mr. Chair, it would appear to me that you're punishing the people who are sharing their children. That our rules punish people who share their children. They're separated, they're sharing their children, and now because the children have equal time with the spouses, you really, the financial aspect and everything else becomes secondary.
Yeah.
Representative, when it comes to actual joint custody, when care is split 50% of the time, our interpretation is that that's indeed correct. The federal law would not allow ADC eligibility in that case, and our state guidelines follow that. That's correct. It's much more difficult for somebody jointly sharing custody to receive public assistance than when one parent has full custody of the child.
I guess that's the question that I would have. Why is it the federal rules, when you're sharing a child time-wise, why is it that becomes more important than the amount of money which you have, which would seem to be to me the biggest criteria for ADC?
Frankly, Representative, I think that's a question that the federal government is reluctant to answer, reluctant to get into. We have on numerous occasions asked for more specific guidelines as to what they would allow and wouldn't allow, and frankly, it's not only a big dollar question to them, but a philosophical question that I believe they prefer not to deal with, and the regulations in this regard have not changed in many years.
I believe, are you done, Bill? Representative Bauman, I know, has some questions to follow up.
No, I'm through. I mean, he's made it clear what the federal policy is, and it wouldn't do us any good to change our state laws then, in your opinion.
I believe that's correct.
I'm curious, Mr. Chair, following up on Representative Bellamy's questions, what is the relationship to this state's two-parent welfare program and the policy that you've described with joint custody?
I'm not quite sure what.
Well, I'm curious. Are these parents who would run into trouble with welfare eligibility because they're sharing custody of a child be eligible under a two-parent welfare program?
Representative, that's even a more difficult issue because generally, no, they would not. If they do not form a single household, and in this case they would not be eligible under either program, either the two-parent program or the ADC basic program.
So your testimony is that because of federal policy, you really have no discretion, the state has no ability to legislate that there be any eligibility for a parent who has joint custody of a child and where the child has considerable contact with the other parent?
Representative, if it gets right down to the situation in which custody is shared 50-50, then yes, I believe that's correct.
Representative Allen.
I can't even follow that.
Let me ask a question. I think Representative Bellamy may have stated it, but let's get it in the record for the purpose of this hearing and not get beyond policy we have any control over. Let me ask it this way, Mr. Neely.
what a court does in a divorce decree in regard to joint legal custody would have no effect one way or the other on AFS eligibility criteria. Is that correct?
Practically speaking, that's correct. It doesn't have an effect unless the individuals actually practice that joint custody.
Thank you. I think for the record that we've got that, and that the issues that we're tackling or addressing, I think they're federal issues rather than state issues. Because Representative Bellamy, as I recall, the inquiry here, I think from you, was let's find out how the joint custody issue affects eligibility for public assistance. And the answer is not at all that particular award wouldn't affect it as a practical matter. It doesn't matter what the courts say in the decree is what you're telling us.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
Any further questions? Thank you. Thank you for coming over. I'll open the work session on House Bill 2293. Council, if you would explain that and tell us what's in our stack here.
House Bill 2293 modifies provisions for transfer of civil actions between district and circuit courts when the initial court lacks subject matter jurisdiction. It also provides for a waiver of subject matter jurisdiction. We have one set of amendments. They're hand engrossed. They amend just the first two pages of the bill. The rest of the bill is the same. There were some concerns that the bill might encourage forum shopping, and these amendments are an attempt to make it clear that that is not what is supposed to happen. On page one of the hand engrossed copy, section two has been replaced with a new section two with language that makes it clear that a party must request a transfer if he is filed in district court and district court lacks jurisdiction. He's required to make a motion for a transfer to circuit court. And if the parties fail to, the court has to act if the court should be aware of it. Down in subsection 3 of section 2, it's a similar provision. It also states that nothing in the act shall be construed to allow a waiver of jurisdiction if a party is aware within the time set for transfer that the court does not have subject matter jurisdiction. On page 2, those same provisions have been inserted in the situation where the person files in circuit court and it should be heard in district court.
Counsel, page 2 at the very end.
Are you referring to that little circled?
Yes. We have a little circled area there.
It needs to be reformatted. But however, nothing needs to come at the conclusion of that paragraph. It's just kind of a form and style matter.
In the 14 days in that sentence, what does it do?
Well, that's the time frame. A motion to transfer shall be made not less than 14 days before the date set for trial.
Okay. The purpose of the bill is not, as I understand it, because I asked the question to the proponents, to consolidate the district and circuit court. I'm starting our discussion of the bill. But is to merely allow where a case is in the wrong court to allow the transference of that case to the correct court. And I think it would be fair to say that the amendments were drawn by the state bar representatives to narrow the bill to make sure it wasn't a consolidation of the two courts, but merely to accomplish the jurisdictional matters as to get a case from one court to the other. And I believe that's what we have before us. The chair would entertain a motion to move this on to full, well, to amend, and then Representative Dix.
Chair.
Yes.
I would move the amendments.
Representative Dix moves House printed House Bill 2293 be amended to reflect what is the typed and hand engrossed version before us now. And I'll place that motion. Is there objection to that motion? Hearing none, so ordered.
Sure.
Representative
Dix. I would move House Bill 2293 to full committee with a due pass recommendation as amended.
Representative Dix moves 2293 as amended to the full with the due pass. Place that motion. Is there further discussion? Hearing none, will you call the roll, please?
Bellamy?
Aye.
Dix?
Aye.
Newman?
Aye. Motion is adopted. Do we have a volunteer? I'll take it before the full.
I think we should assign that to Representative Miller, since he isn't here.
Maybe we should do that on the one of the others coming before.
Well, it could be, yeah.
Yeah. I'll open the work session on 2294. And Council, if you would, we had a public hearing on this early on, I think, before Council was on board.
Yes.
But if you would just give us a description of the bill. Are we considering, we have amendments, or are we considering the bill as printed?
The bill as printed. We've received no amendments on
Okay.
it. Well, the bill basically proposes to increase the witness fees and mileage reimbursement in non-criminal cases. It increases the witness fees from $5 to $30 per day, and the mileage reimbursement from 8 to 25 cents per mile.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Dix.
Perhaps Council could tell me, do we have another bill in committee that relates to witness fees? Do you know?
I do not know.
That's not a reasonable response to your question, Representative Dix, given the number of bills in committee.
I just thought maybe she might have seen a bill across her desk relating to witness fees aside from this.
Which one are we looking at? We're talking about whether or not there's another bill relating to witness fees in regard to the present bill, which is 2294. Representative Dix.
Are you prepared to entertain a motion?
No, I'm not prepared at this point.
Okay. My concern with the bill is, and we got into this in during the hearing, the public hearing, is that this only relates to non-criminal proceedings. It has no fiscal impact on the state that I know of, or does it?
It does not have. Then our memories are going to have to be refreshed. If you could quickly. It was my thought the increase in witness fees would be all solely to private parties.
Yeah. Excuse me, for the record, Kingsley Click with the State Court Administrator's Office. The Indigent Defense Board did submit a fiscal impact statement as the bill is currently drafted. During testimony, we understood the bar to say that they were going to be offering amendments to take away the fiscal impact, because the problem was, by just stating non-criminal, the civil cases for which we might be paying would include juvenile cases and civil commitment cases, because currently they get paid the same rates as civil. But right now, civil and criminal are the same, and that's where we had a concern, and they testified they were going to have amendments. I have noticed also in some research consensus that the parole board has in its statute something that states that they that their witnesses will be paid the same rate as in civil cases. And, excuse me, Mr. Chair, the Representative Dix asked about another bill dealing with witnesses.
Yes.
There was. It's 2186. You passed it out. It went to the floor and is now over on the Senate side in Senate Judiciary, though it's not been heard.
Subject matter was?
It was on defining who is responsible for paying witness fees. The Judicial Department sponsored it, and it defined clearly when we paid for defense witnesses and when the county paid for prosecution witnesses.
Yes, Representative Dix.
I know that when we get into work session, we don't like to do this, but if amendments were going to be offered, I'm curious why they haven't been.
I don't think there are amendments to be offered.
Okay. So there is. So what you're saying is there is a fiscal impact with this bill.
Mike Hansen, who was then the administrator of the Indigent Defense Board, I have a copy of one that he submitted to Katie Thorne that listed, Barbara Torrey's of our office prepared it for him, that listed $100,880 as the impact if it were unamended on indigent defense for witnesses in juvenile and in mental commitment proceedings.
We don't have it. Do you have it?
Yeah. Well, it went to Katie Thorne, and usually a copy also goes to your fiscal people at the same time.
Uh-huh.
I don't know. I'm sorry. Stated 2487. Would you like me to make a copy? Or?
Representative Dix.
Well, I would suggest rather than take the committee's time, we try and track down the fiscal statement and then get back to this later on in the work session if we can track down the fiscal statement, if there is one. My concerns on the bill relate to the criminal cases where you're asking individuals in our community to take time off from work and they are going to receive $5. Is that the correct
That's
amount?
What they get now.
To testify in a criminal case. Some of us have an easier time than others, and I've been told, for instance, that some employers will give that person a full day off. I have a number of people in my district who go in and punch a clock, and I can tell you right now, on a time clock, those folks aren't going to get the day off to come and testify in a criminal case, and I think it's unfair that we ask them to testify in a criminal case, and the state only gives them $5 to testify when in some instances they're losing between $60 and $75 a day, or even more, by missing work. And these haven't been amended since 1959. Is that correct? Witness fees? My notes indicate that during testimony in the public hearing, witness fees have not been amended since 1959. So we pay witnesses $5 a day because that was the going rate in 1959.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to bog this bill down unnecessarily by sending it down and addressing the criminal question. Then that's why I asked the question about another bill being in this committee, because it's my intent at some point during this session to address the criminal witness fee question if we had another bill.
Mr. Chair.
I'm done.
Representative Bauman.
I'd just like to respond in part with a rationale that favors this bill for exactly the reasons that you just spoke of, and that is witness fees in criminal cases, half of them are paid by the state, and there would be a fiscal impact to increasing the witness fees for criminal cases. And I'm not sure that I'm ready to address that or that Ways and Means is ready to address that this session, but I think that if we increase witness fees and mileage in civil cases, that increases terrifically the logical argument, which obviously already exists today, for increasing the amount that the state pays in criminal cases. And I agree with you, Representative Dix, but I think this is a positive first step. And I
I would agree with Representative Baumann, and that's why I think certainly we should move this one down. The question remains, is there a fiscal impact with this bill without amendments? And the court administrator's office tells us, in fact, there is. So.
Mm-hmm. Can we have a copy of that?
Yes.
That we can have for the, so we can get copies of it right away.
Okay. But, just to clarify, I have no problem sending this down, but I along with Representative Baumann, would like to address the issue perhaps at another time regarding criminal fees, if it's not this session, those who serve on this committee in the future. Maybe they,
Representative Dix, let's dispose of this for the day. We'll get copies of that fiscal and allow counsel to draw up amendments in regard to that. Well, why don't you take the lead on drawing up the amendments? I'm